Chapter 17, Progress, by Ibram X. Kendi. That's what we mean when we say America is exceptional. Not that our nation has been flawless from the start, but that we have shown the capacity to change and make life better for those who follow. So said President Barack Obama in his farewell address in January 2017, just days before Donald Trump took office. And yet, many Americans did not see a more perfect union coming. After all, Trump had been endorsed by a leading Ku Klux Klan newspaper and one of the organization's former leaders, David Duke. He was advised by white nationalists like Steve Bannon. He made a political name for himself questioning Obama's citizenship. Trump campaigned on making America great again after the first black president. He framed Latino immigrants as rapists. For many Americans, Trump was not forging a path forward to make life better. Instead, he represented a racist past they believed the nation had left behind, and his victory a reversal of the gradual racial progress they had been told was the American story. Obama, himself an avatar of that progress, knew he had to explain this in his address. "Yes, our progress has been uneven," he said. "For every two steps forward, it often feels we take one step back. But the long sweep of America has been defined by forward motion, a constant widening of our founding creed to embrace all and not just some." Obama was embracing a national mythology in which America was marching forward and righting past wrongs, an epic, righteous journey that had led to his own election 8 years earlier. This mantra of steady, incremental change has long been a part of the American creed. Politicians of all races and parties convey it constantly. "I once believed it. Sure, the country may have begun in slavery, but it fought a war to end it. It passed 3 new amendments to the Constitution to end slavery and give citizenship to those formerly enslaved and to grant the men among them the right to vote. And though, in the decades that followed, those rights were violently denied, eventually the nation's institutions acted to ensure them. In 1954, the Supreme Court declared segregated public schools unconstitutional. A decade later, Congress passed and President Lyndon B. Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. President Johnson appointed the former NAACP attorney Thurgood Marshall to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1967. Into the 1970s and 80s, the black middle class started emerging and became more visible in culture, media, and politics. There were figures like Ed Bradley, who became the first black White House television correspondent in 1976, and Harold Washington, who became the first black mayor of Chicago in 1983 and inspired Obama's generation. In the 1990s, President Bill Clinton appointed what was at the time the most diverse cabinet in history. At the end of the 20th century and the turn of the 21st, black women and especially men were visible in politics, sports, entertainment, and mass media. People like Michael Jordan, Carol Moseley Braun, Jesse Jackson, Whitney Houston, Tiger Woods, Denzel Washington, Jay-Z, Spike Lee, Robin Roberts, Halle Berry, and Bryant Gumbel. By 2003, media moguls Oprah Winfrey and Robert L. Johnson had become billionaires. All the success stories of these individuals ostensibly demonstrated the forward march of the black community. With Barack Obama arriving on the stage of American history, community representation transmuted into national embodiment. I stand here knowing that my story is part of the larger American story, that I owe a debt to all of those who came before me, and that in no other country on earth is my story even possible, Obama said during his breakout keynote speech at the Democratic National Convention in 2004. 4 years later, when Obama was elected president, he had come to embody racial progress in the arc of American history itself. Obama did not make American history when he won the U.S. presidency on November 4th, 2008. He became American history. In American history, popularly written as the story of incremental and steady racial progress. Historic win, blared the headline of the Philadelphia Inquirer the day after his election in 2008. Change has come to America. Nearly 70% of Americans agreed that his election would improve race relations in the country. To some, it was a watershed moment. In answer to the question, is America past racism against black people? I say the answer is yes, Columbia University linguist John McWhorter wrote in Forbes weeks after Obama's election. Our proper concern is not whether racism still exists, but whether it remains a serious problem. The election of Obama proved, as nothing else could have, that it no longer does. But when seen as the defining narrative of American history, this vision of our past as a march of racial progress is ahistorical, mythical, and incomplete. Even as those civil rights victories of the 1950s and 60s were transpiring in the courts and streets, the unemployment rates of black Americans were rising. These persistently poor socioeconomic conditions, not to mention police violence, led to urban rebellions in 1964, 1965, 1966, and 1967, a year when Martin Luther King Jr. said, "That dream that I had that day in 1963 has, at many points, turned into a nightmare." In 1968, in response to these rebellions, President Johnson and repeatedly presidential candidate Richard Nixon called for law and order. During a post-civil rights period of supposed progress, American society also became obsessed with a destructive fear of black criminality. The call for law and order gave way to the war on drugs beginning in the 1970s and to mass incarceration in the 1980s and 90s. Meanwhile, police violence persisted, and new forms of voter suppression became so sophisticated that they contributed to Republican presidential victories in Florida in 2000 and Ohio in 2004. In 2009, the first black president came into office during the Great Recession, which produced the widest racial wealth gap between black and white Americans since the government began recording such data. When the long sweep of American history is cast as a constant widening of equity and justice, it overlooks this parallel constant widening of inequity and injustice. The two forces have existed in tandem, dueling throughout our history. The northern states gradually emancipated enslaved black people in the early United States, a step forward for justice, but at the same time, these states gradually or immediately stripped freed black people of their civil or voting rights, a step forward for injustice. In 1807, importation of Africans was prohibited by Congress, a step forward for nonviolence, but this led to a consequent boom in the violent and disruptive domestic trade of enslaved people and the breeding and spreading of the enslaved population, a step forward for brutal violence. In 1865, Congress abolished chattel slavery, stepping towards justice, but this immediately led to a series of racist black codes in southern states that bound and regulated the movements of freed peoples and shifted the nation towards injustice. In the late 1860s, radical Republican congressmen abolished these black codes, reconstructed southern states, and extended civil and voting rights to black men, another step forward for equity. But in another step towards inequity, lynchings and Jim Crow reconstructed white supremacy and rescinded some civil and voting rights by the 1890s. The singular racial history of the United States is therefore a dual racial history of two opposing forces, historical steps towards equity and justice, and historical steps towards inequity and injustice, but foregrounded in the telling are the steps towards equity and justice as part of a grand American narrative march of liberty and equality for all. This popular construct of racial progress does more than conceal and obfuscate. It actually undermines the effort to achieve and maintain equality. You see this in the majority opinion written by Chief Justice John Roberts in Shelby County v. Holder in 2013. In that case, the Supreme Court struck down the federal preclearance section of the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which required certain states and counties with a history of electoral racism to receive federal approval before changing local voting laws or practices. In his majority opinion, Roberts acknowledged that there had been a need for strong medicine against racism in 1965, but argued that since then, progress had rendered such policies unnecessary. There is no denying, however, that the conditions that originally justified these measures no longer characterize voting in the covered jurisdictions, he wrote. Things have changed dramatically. In the aftermath of this decision, multiple Republican-dominated states freed of federal oversight, passed laws that disenfranchised black people by limiting early voting and same-day registration, and instituting voter ID laws that targeted African-American voters with surgical precision, to quote the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. 14 states had new voter restrictions in time for the 2016 election, including Ohio and Wisconsin. These new voter suppression policies were crucial to Trump's victory. And following Trump's defeat in 2020, Republican state legislators have introduced more than 350 laws in 47 states that would make it harder for Americans, particularly Black Americans, to vote. Inequality lives, in part, because Americans of every generation have been misled into believing that racial progress is inevitable and ongoing, that racial progress is America's manifest destiny, that racial progress defines the arc of American history since 1619, that things have changed dramatically. In fact, this has more often been rhetoric than reality, more often myth than history. Saying that the nation can progress racially is a necessary statement of hope. Saying that the nation has progressed racially is usually a statement of ideology, one that has been used all too often to obscure the opposite reality of racist progress. And it's been this way since the beginning. The propaganda of racial progress took its initial form in the era of slavery. Proponents of the idea held that slavery was justified by the fact that enslavers had improved the lot of the Africans they were enslaving. In the 1660s, prominent English minister Richard Baxter urged American planters in A Christian Directory to make it your chief end in buying and using slaves to win them to Christ and save their souls. The leading theologian in early colonial America, Cotton Mather, admired Baxter and built on his ideas. You are better fed and better clothed and better managed by far than you would be if you were your own men, Mather informed enslaved Africans in Boston in the 1696 pamphlet, A Good Master, Well Served. It was one of the first articulations of racial progress in colonial America. American slavery was better than miserable African freedom, Mather argued. If they obey their masters, he informed enslaved people, their souls will be washed white in the blood of the Lamb. By the time of the American Revolution, the first full-blown abolitionist movement had emerged, influencing a newly emergent anti-slavery rhetoric, even among enslavers like Thomas Jefferson. In 1774, he drafted a powerful freedom manifesto, a summary view of the rights of British America, in which he accused the British king of holding back the march of racial progress that the colonists wanted. The abolition of domestic slavery is the great object of desire in those colonies where it was unhappily introduced in their infant state, Jefferson wrote. Several of the admirers of A Summary View printed and circulated it widely, launching Jefferson into national recognition. 2 years later, Jefferson found himself in Philadelphia as a delegate at the Second Continental Congress, drafting the Declaration of Independence. The history of His Present Majesty is a history of unremitting injuries and usurpations, Jefferson declared. He then listed every wrong, saving perhaps the worst of the king's abuses for last. The King of Great Britain has waged what Jefferson, an enslaver, called a cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of life and liberty in the persons of a distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere, or to incur miserable death in their transportation hither. The king had suppressed every legislative attempt to prohibit or to restrain this execrable commerce. The delegates ended up cutting this anti-slavery passage in its entirety before finalizing the Declaration of Independence on July 4, 1776. But they cannot erase its powerful framing that the founding fathers were not responsible for slavery, but rather were ushering in a new age of freedom, that Great Britain was to blame for the trade in enslaved persons, and that racial progress was on the way through American independence. In reality, some of the Americans who decried British tyranny were themselves opposed to abolition. In his notes on the proceedings of the Second Continental Congress concerning this early draft of the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson wrote, "The clause reprobating the enslaving the inhabitants of Africa was struck out in complaisance to South Carolina and Georgia, who had never attempted to restrain the importation of slaves, and who on the contrary still wished to continue it. Our northern brethren also, I believe, felt a little tender under those censures, for though their people have very few slaves themselves, yet they had been pretty considerable carriers of them to others." Jefferson tried to justify American inaction on the trade in enslaved persons and on slavery by placing the blame on King George's head. But the burden of culpability rested also on American shoulders in both the North and the South. Soon, the justification for inaction took a different form. Not long after helping to establish the Methodist Church in America in 1784, Thomas Coke started circulating petitions to abolish slavery. In 1785, he led a delegation of abolitionists to Mount Vernon to convince the future first president of the United States to join their movement. But George Washington declined to sign the petition or publicly support the Methodist anti-slavery efforts on the premise that it would be dangerous to make a frontal attack on a prejudice which is beginning to decrease. Washington, perhaps knowingly and strategically, exonerated himself from taking a political stand against slavery on the grounds that progress was being made. Slavery persisted and grew, protected by the argument that it was going away. Still, slavery was a political, moral, and intellectual quandary for the founding fathers who saw themselves as part of the Age of Enlightenment. They were not so blinded by the myth of racial progress that they failed to understand the contradiction of a republic founded on the principles of freedom and equality in which one-fifth of the population was held in bondage. They were embarrassed enough that they left the words slavery and slave out of the U.S. Constitution entirely. The awkwardness of the topic did not hinder the economic institution's growth. In the aftermath of the American Revolution, many northern states that were less reliant on enslaved labor did pass gradual abolition laws, and some enslavers in the Upper South did free their captives, but most in the South did not. Jefferson himself freed only two enslaved people in his lifetime. Americans in both the North and the South came to see slavery as a necessary evil, the only way to pay off their debts and build the new nation. Cotton gins were invented to speedily remove seeds from cotton fibers, making cotton produced by enslaved labor immensely profitable and leading to an insatiable demand for more land and more labor. Enslavers were marching into the Louisiana Territory, which Jefferson secured from France in 1803. The number of enslaved Africans swelled by 70%, from 697,681 in the first federal census of 1790 to 1,191,362 in 1810, and more than tripled over the next 50 years. As slavery grew, so did the cries to abolish it. Still, many white people, even those who were anti-slavery, couldn't stomach the idea of black equality. A solution was found in the idea of colonization, freeing and civilizing black people, then sending them out of the country. The idea had been proposed by Jefferson in his Notes on the State of Virginia, published in 1785. This new form of racial progress envisioned the United States as a white ethnostate that avoided what Jefferson argued would be a never-ending race war. Black people should be brought up until the females should be 18 and the males 21 years of age, when they should be colonized to such place as the circumstances of the time should render most proper. To replace them, the nation should send vessels to other parts of the world for an equal number of white inhabitants, Jefferson wrote. Into the antebellum era, a big tent of enslavers and centrist anti-slavery reformers, both inspired by Jefferson, came to see colonization as a way to resist those enslaved persons and free abolitionists pressing for the immediate end of slavery. Enslavers came to favor the idea of colonizing all free black people out of the country to better control the restive population of enslaved people. The minutes from the founding meeting of the American Colonization Society in 1816 record that Virginia Congressman John Randolph argued that colonization would materially tend to secure slavery, casting off those free black people whose presence incited mischief and discontent among the enslaved. The 8th Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Henry Clay, agreed in his speech at the meeting. The society would ignore the delicate question of abolition and only promote the deportation of the free black population, Clay stated. Can there be a nobler cause than that which, he argued, while it proposes to rid our own country of a useless and pernicious, if not a dangerous, portion of its population, contemplates the spreading of the arts of civilized life and the possible redemption from ignorance and barbarism of a benighted quarter of the globe? Centrist anti-slavery reformers had similar plans for free black people and different plans for the enslaved. Free black people must be trained for self-government and then return to their land of origin, New Jersey clergyman Robert Finley wrote in the Colonization Movement's pioneering manifesto, Thoughts on the Colonization of Free Blacks. For the enslaved, he advocated that they be gradually freed over time, as many were in northern states when they reached a certain age and colonized out of the United States. By this means, the evil of slavery will be diminished, and in a way so gradual as to prepare the whites for the happy and progressive change. The manifesto was published in 1816, the year he helped enslavers found the American Colonization Society. The American Colonization Society grew into the preeminent racial reform organization in the United States by the late 1820s. By 1832, every northern state legislature had passed resolutions endorsing colonization, while many southern white colonizationists sought to remove free black people. Northern white colonizationists were typically energized by the scenario of removing all black people, enslaved and free. Both viewed colonization as incremental progress. Enslaved or free Africans would be civilized and gradually emancipated and sent back to Africa to civilize miserable Africans, thus establishing slavery itself as an instrument of racial progress. As the retired Jefferson put it in a letter to an anti-slavery sympathizer John Lynch in 1811, having long ago made up my mind on this subject, I have no hesitation in saying that colonization is most advantageous for themselves as well as for us. He went on to suggest that the plan would also be advantageous for Africa, a continent lacking the useful arts. Schooled free black people, Jefferson argued, would carry back to Africa the seeds of civilization, which might render their sojournment here a blessing in the end to that country. By the 1790s, the abolitionist movement that had begun during the era of the American Revolution had ebbed. White abolitionists, in reviving the movement in the 1830s and 40s, mostly opposed gradual abolition and colonization. Instead, they pushed for immediate emancipation while fashioning a new form of racial progress, one focused on individual behavior and acceptance. Some white abolitionists agreed with William Lloyd Garrison, who wholeheartedly believed that black people had acquired and would continue to acquire the esteem, confidence, and patronage of the whites in proportion to their increase in knowledge and moral improvement. Garrison called on black people to follow this lead and behave in an upstanding manner to make white Americans more comfortable setting their brethren free. In an address before black Philadelphians in 1831, Garrison said, "If you are temperate, industrious, peaceable, and pious, if you return good for evil and blessing for cursing, you will show to the world that the slaves can be emancipated without danger. But if you are turbulent, idle, and vicious, you will put arguments into the mouths of tyrants and cover your friends with confusion and shame." This strategy of upliftsuasion that focused on policing black behavior actually reinforced racism in slavery, Garrison implied that it was turbulent black behavior that drove racist reactions among white people who would otherwise hold black people in esteem, an inversion of the true cause and effect of racism. Likewise, his encouragement of behavioral uplift sidelined the role of anti-racist activism and resistance at a time when they were needed the most. Indeed, racism and Southern slavery were spreading and becoming more powerful in the 1830s and 40s, but many white and black abolitionists failed to acknowledge this racist progress. As Garrison said in the Philadelphia speech, "The signs of the times do indeed show forth great and glorious and sudden changes in the condition of the oppressed." In the summer of 1847, Garrison wrote in The Liberator that the slave power had declined in the past 10 years, leading to a gradual abatement of the prejudice which we have been deploring. These remarks came in the middle of the Mexican-American War, a battle that began after the United States annexed Texas, and perhaps reflected his anxiety about slavery's Western expansion more than his belief in its imminent demise. The war with Mexico helped nationalize the slavery debate, since many white Northerners who might not have personally supported abolition nevertheless worried that the new territories would be controlled by the enslavers' interests, shutting out free white labor and increasing the political power of the Southern slaveholding states over the Northern states. Congressional representatives from the North and the South had been in a contentious battle since 1846 over the Wilmot Proviso, which proposed a ban on slavery in any territories acquired during the war. As sectional political tensions over slavery's expansion heated up in the halls of Congress, some abolitionists established a new rhetorical ground. Slavery and anti-black racism were one and the same, and if slavery ended, racism would vanish as well. Complexional caste is tolerated nowhere excepting in the immediate vicinage of slavery, Garrison declared in 1847, adding that racism's utter eradication is not to be expected until that hideous system be overthrown. French scholar Alexis de Tocqueville, who traveled across the United States in the early 1830s, had a different observation. "The prejudice of the race appears stronger in the states which have abolished slavery than in those where it still exists, and nowhere is it so intolerant as in those states where servitude has never been known," Tocqueville wrote in his classic 1835 treatise, Democracy in America. Garrison accompanied Frederick Douglass on a speaking tour in the Old Northwest, what is now the easternmost portion of the Midwest. En route through Pennsylvania, he came face to face with racism outside of the immediate vicinage of slavery. When they arrived in Ohio in August 1847, every single free state in the region had restricted black people from voting and serving in the militia in the prior half century. During this period, Ohio and Illinois explicitly named whiteness as a prerequisite for jurors. Black jury service in Indiana, Michigan, and the territory that would become the state of Wisconsin was unheard of. By 1851, many Midwestern states had restricted black people from owning land or contracting for labor by forcing them to provide certificates of freedom and posting bonds to ensure that they would not become dependent. Several states prevented black people who had recently arrived from residing there altogether. Abraham Lincoln came of age politically in one of these states. As a young Illinois politician, he held both racist and anti-slavery views. He expressed the former, indulged the latter when it suited him politically. During his senatorial bid against Stephen Douglas in 1858, Lincoln appeased the racist ideas of Illinois voters by announcing, "I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of bringing about in any way the social and political equality of the black and white races. That I am not, nor ever have been, in favor of making voters or jurors of Negroes, nor of qualifying them to hold office, nor to intermarry with white people." In the same speech, Lincoln expressed a belief in a physical difference between the white and black races that would forever forbid the two races living together on terms of social and political equality. During his presidency, Lincoln opposed the expansion of slavery while also supporting colonization schemes as late as 1862. Lincoln's positions on slavery, colonization, and emancipation shifted with the winds of political and military expediency stirred by the Civil War. But when it became a military necessity to save the Union, Lincoln issued and signed the Emancipation Proclamation. While the proclamation opened the door to enrolling around 180,000 black soldiers in the Union Army, it ended up freeing fewer than 200,000 black people on the day it was signed, nearly 500,000 black people in border states, approximately 300,000 black people in Union-occupied Confederate areas, including the entire state of Tennessee and portions of Virginia and Louisiana, and more than 3 million people in Confederate territories remained enslaved. It was incumbent upon those enslaved black people to emancipate themselves, and that is precisely what they did, running away from enslavers to Union lines. Many of them joined the Union Army, turning the tide of the war. Nevertheless, in the next 2 years, Lincoln sat for journalists, artists, and photographers seeking to sculpt him into history as the great emancipator. Painter Francis Bicknell Carpenter spent 6 months at the White House in 1864 to visually recreate the moment when Lincoln ended slavery. First reading of the Emancipation Proclamation of President Lincoln was intended to commemorate this new epoch in the history of liberty, Bicknell wrote. Some people who witnessed the construction of Lincoln as the great emancipator realized that racial progress mythology was being used to cleanse white people of their guilt and responsibility. "The Negro has saved himself," Ralph Waldo Emerson observed around this time, "and the white man very patronizingly says, 'I have saved you.'" White people, embodied in the enslaver, enslaved black people, and then white people, embodied in Lincoln, freed black people. In the end, it was white people who righted the wrong of slavery. This formulation stemmed not from an accurate reading of events, but from the myth of racial progress. Upon this myth, each successive generation of white Americans is let off the hook for the legacy of slavery. Politicians and the public alike can claim that this sin remains a part of the past, that the country has rid itself of the stain, and that there's no need for anti-racist remedies like reparations. Radical Reconstruction did bring about actual racial progress. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, ending chattel slavery, granting black people citizenship, and providing black men the ability to vote, were passed. Southern constitutional conventions from 1867 to 1869 included black delegates, about half of whom had been born in slavery, and white and black elected officials introduced many Southern states' first publicly funded education systems, penitentiaries, orphanages, and asylums for the mentally ill, expanded women's rights and guaranteed rights to black people, and reorganized local governments. And yet, as Eric Foner showed in his classic study of the period, Reconstruction, America's Unfinished Revolution, These advances furnished a ready excuse for why more could not be done to achieve true equity and justice for all. The white leaders who advocated for black men's right to vote absolved themselves of a continued commitment to overturning lingering racist policies and practices by reasoning that black men could now save themselves and their families through the ballot box. For their own benefit, newly emancipated black people should not continue to be kept wards of the nation, said reformer Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who had commanded black soldiers in the Civil War. Or, as Congressional Representative and future President James A. Garfield put it, the 15th Amendment confers upon the African race the care of its own destiny. It places their fortunes in their own hands. These sentiments were widespread despite the fact that the formerly enslaved escaped their bondage with absolutely nothing. An Illinois newspaper proclaimed, "The Negro is now a voter and a citizen. Let him hereafter take his chances in the battle of life." From this point forward, white Americans were ready to blame black behavior and not racism and the deprivations of 250 years of enslavement for persisting racial inequities. Meanwhile, under the cover of this narrative of racial progress, racism was advancing. Fierce resistance to black economic freedom, civil rights, and political power held countless black Americans in a second slavery with few rights and powers. Violence from white terrorist groups like the new Ku Klux Klan and the Red Shirts allowed white supremacists to regain power in the early 1870s, while the Panic of 1873 drove many black Southerners into debt servitude. In 1875, Congress passed the Civil Rights Act, which prohibited racist discrimination in public places and public facilities, including those that provided transportation or food. But the following year, when 9 million people, or one-fifth of the U.S. population, attended the centennial of Jefferson's Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia, celebrated as a monument to that palladium of our nation's liberties, another series of black codes was already restricting the rights of black people to work and live in southern states. Finally, with the Compromise of 1877, Reconstruction was brought to a close. The last federal troops were withdrawn from the South, and Jim Crow was born. As the nation celebrated a post-war unity, Southerners started hailing the New South. America was ostensibly marching forward, and if black people were not keeping up, it was their own fault. In 1883, the Supreme Court used the language of progress to strike down the Civil Rights Act of 1875, opening the legal door to a raft of new Jim Crow laws. When a man has emerged from slavery and by the aid of beneficent legislation has shaken off the inseparable concomitants of that state, Justice Joseph P. Bradley concluded, writing for the majority, there must be some stage in the progress of his elevation when he takes the rank of a mere citizen and ceases to be the special favorite of the laws. The court twisted the litigant's request to be treated equitably into a request to be the special favorite of the laws. The New York Times applauded the court's undoing of Congress's work. Nearly 70 years later, after the Second World War, the United States emerged as a global superpower, having founded the United Nations and formulated economic plans to protect European nations from staggering war debts. However, the United States and the Soviet Union soon took up arms in a war for influence in decolonizing countries in Latin America, Asia, Africa, and the Middle East. Jim Crow segregation in the United States had been a topic of political discourse in the USSR since the late 1920s, and Black Americans' experiences of racist policies and violence had been featured in the Soviet press to argue for the superiority of communism over capitalism, and to charge the United States with hypocrisy for claiming to be the exemplar of global freedom. Racism experienced by Black Americans took on a new significance during the Cold War. The U.S. government tried to reconcile the nation's new image as a global beacon of morality and democracy with worldwide press coverage of its pervasive racism. In 1947, the Truman administration issued To Secure These Rights, the report of the President's Committee on Civil Rights, one of the most powerful indictments of racism ever to come from the U.S. government, a sign of progress in the midst of racism. But that same year, the NAACP offered the 94-page An Appeal to the World, a statement on the denial of human rights to minorities in the case of citizens of Negro descent in the United States of America, and an appeal to the United Nations for redress. And in 1951, the Civil Rights Congress delivered a petition, We Charge Genocide, to a meeting of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights in Paris. The petition documented 152 killings or lynchings and 344 other genocidal crimes against African Americans from 1945 to 1951. American officials grew increasingly concerned that a public projection of racism against its own citizens would cause the United States to lose the support of people of color abroad, especially in those decolonizing African and Asian countries, while increasing their support for joining forces with the USSR. Scurrying into damage control, what is now the United States Information Agency, USIA, produced and circulated around the world a document titled The Negro in American Life. There began in the United States a theory of racial inferiority, which became a key tenet in support of slavery and later of economic and social discrimination, the pamphlet stated in 1950 or 1951. It is against this background that the progress which the Negro has made and the steps still needed for the full solutions of his problems must be measured. The Negro in American Life ended up advancing the same narrative that Americans do today, a celebration of racial progress. In the context of the Cold War, the government used racial progress rhetoric to prop up the United States as the world's leading democracy. While the Negro in American Life did not want decolonizing nations to see the racist present, Black Americans lived it. Around this time, the majority of white Americans seemed to favor laws and policies that promoted segregated housing. In 1946, only 28% of Southerners and 54% of Northerners with a high school diploma believed that Black Americans should be entitled to equal job opportunities. Degrees of support correlated to education level, with just 20% of Southerners and 46% of Northerners with a grade school education in support. In a 1950 Roper Center survey on public school integration, only 41% of respondents said that children of all races and colors should be allowed to go to the same schools together everywhere in the country. But still, the USIA pamphlet stated that at the turn of the century, the majority of whites, Northern as well as Southern, were unabashed in their estimate of the Negro as an inferior. Today, there is scarcely a community where that concept has not been drastically modified. Like their predecessors, the writers of this pamphlet situated the past, not the present, or in some cases, the status of individual Black elites, not the masses, as defining the standards of measurements for progress. Over the past 50 years, progress for the Negro had occurred in all areas at a tremendous pace, according to the Negro in American Life. The pamphlet disclosed the existence of large landowners, of wealthy businessmen, of professionals, of tremendous advances in literacy rates and college enrollments. Much remains to be done because the average income of white Americans was still substantially better than that of Negroes, the pamphlet stated. But the gap is closing. The racial progress story becomes quite familiar from there. In 1954, with Brown v. Board of Education, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that segregated public schools were unconstitutional. Racial progress. The Montgomery bus boycott began a movement for desegregation across the South in 1955. Racial progress. President Dwight D. Eisenhower sent federal troops to escort the Little Rock Nine in 1957. Racial progress. The lunch counter sit-ins by black college students in 1960 led to the desegregation of Southern businesses. Racial progress. Freedom riders helped desegregate bus terminals in 1961. Racial progress. The March on Washington and the dream of Martin Luther King Jr. made nationwide news in 1963. Racial progress. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed. Racial progress. But what is left out of this story is that this second Reconstruction was needed because the first Reconstruction, after the Civil War ended in 1865, failed to bring into being and sustain an equitable nation, an effort undermined by the propaganda of racial progress. What is left out of the story of our time is that a third Reconstruction is needed because the second Reconstruction failed to actualize King's dream, again undermined by the racial progress propaganda. On June 4, 1965, President Lyndon B. Johnson gave the commencement address at Howard University. It is a tribute to America that once aroused the courts and the Congress, the president and most of the people have been the allies of progress, he said. But he also showed why decades of racial progress rhetoric had been short-sighted. Progress has primarily come for a growing middle-class minority, while for poor black people, the walls are rising and the gulf is widening, Johnson pointed out. 35 years ago, the rate of unemployment for Negroes and whites was about the same, he noted. Tonight, the Negro rate is twice as high. In recent decades, Johnson added, income disparities, disparities in poverty rates, disparities in infant mortality, and urban segregation were all increasing. Still, Johnson's racial progress message lived on in history, and his warnings died in the fires of the late 1960s. After he signed the Voting Rights Act into law on August 6, 1965, the USIA again made sure the Cold Warring world digested it as a sign of progress. In 1965, agents composed and circulated For the Dignity of Man, America's Civil Rights Program. Progress had arrived, the pamphlet stated, and now racism had been mostly confined to individuals in some states and local governments. It conveyed to the world a middle-class, interracial, harmonious United States, a country most black Americans would have hardly recognized. 1 year earlier, Malcolm X had stood before a meeting of the Congress of Racial Equality, CORE, at a Methodist church in Cleveland. How can you thank a man for giving you what's already yours? He asked, speaking of the Civil Rights Act, which was making its way through Congress at the time. You haven't even made progress. If what's being given to you, you should have had already. That's not progress. Malcolm X and others remain skeptical of all the progress rhetoric. To skeptical African Americans, it was not surprising when, 5 days after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, police brutality set off the six-day Watts Rebellion against racism, one of the most destructive urban rebellions in U.S. history. President Johnson was stunned. "After all we've accomplished, how can it be?" he asked a top aide. And then came more than 100 urban rebellions in the summer of 1967, and Black people demanding more than civil and voting rights. Ruled by white minorities in majority Black counties, neighborhoods, and cities, Black people demanded democracy. They demanded political power, Black power. But Johnson spoke for many white Americans when he responded to the uprisings in his State of the Union address on January 17, 1968, by stating to bipartisan applause that the American people have had enough of rising crime and lawlessness. Just 6 weeks later, the commission Johnson had established the previous summer to study the causes of the urban rebellions issued its report. According to the 11-member Kerner Commission, the main issue was not crime and lawlessness, but white racism. "Our nation is moving towards two societies," the report proclaimed in its most famous passage, "one Black, one white, separate and unequal." To arrest this alarming development, the commission recommended the creation of higher-paying, higher-status jobs for Black people, a federal open occupancy law that would prohibit racist discrimination against prospective Black renters and homebuyers, and an increase in political representation in local governments for poor Black communities. But in the afterglow of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, as the United States proclaimed racial progress to the world and to itself, Johnson ignored most of the commission's recommendations. The second Reconstruction's last victory was the Civil Rights Act of 1968, which targeted racism in housing. "We have come some of the way, not near all of it," Johnson remarked on its passage in the aftermath of King's assassination. "There is much yet to do." This iteration of the racial progress refrain, which can be traced back to the Cold War pamphlet, The Negro in American Life, focuses our attention on how the United States has come a long way, the past, and how America has a long way to go, the future. This past-future logic has compelled generation after generation to overlook the present, indeed the presence of racism. In the 1970s, newly emergent conservatives, as they self-identified, broke from the liberal past-future refrain that the nation still had a ways to go. They pointed to the legislative gains of the preceding decades to claim that the nation had arrived. Black people in the here and now were no longer facing racism. Conservatives framed supporters of affirmative action as hardcore racists of reverse discrimination against white people, as Yale law professor Robert Bork claimed in 1978. Such arguments echoed the Supreme Court ruling in 1883 that found the Civil Rights Act of 1875 unconstitutional, gutting the anti-racist protections of the Reconstruction Amendments on the grounds that Black Americans should not be treated as the special favorite. Like enslavers and centrist anti-slavery Americans agreeing on the need to colonize free Black people, but disagreeing on colonizing the enslaved, leading white Republicans and Democrats agreed that substantial progress had been made and disagreed only about whether racism was over. During the presidential debate on October 28, 1980, between incumbent Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, an audience member highlighted the racist policies that non-white Americans faced in schools, jobs, and housing. Reagan replied that he was eternally optimistic about race relations and expressed his belief that we've made great progress from the days when I was young and when this country didn't even know it had a racial problem. Carter acknowledged that the United States still had a long way to go, but highlighted the good racial progress promoted through democratic policies involving unemployment compensation, the minimum wage, welfare, and national health insurance. By the 1990s, the gulf between the rhetoric of racial progress and the reality for millions of Black Americans had grown wider as the former became more and more triumphant. In 1995, 4 years after the LAPD brutally beat Rodney King, Dinesh D'Souza, a former Reagan aide, published a book titled The End of Racism. This was the year of the O.J. Simpson trial, with its racially polarizing verdict and revelations of racist LAPD behavior and the beginning of the apex of Black incarceration rates during the war on drugs after Bill Clinton signed the devastatingly punitive 1994 crime bill. 2 years later, in their 1997 blockbuster, America in Black and White, Manhattan Institute fellow Abigail Thernstrom and her husband, Harvard historian Stephen Thernstrom, argued that few whites are now racist and that what dominates current race relations is Black anger and white surrender. By the century's end, the term colorblind was often being used by politicians and thinkers to describe the correct way to think about race, since so much progress had been achieved and apparently all Americans were already being treated equally. Colorblind white people were telling Black Americans to stop playing the race card. Black cultures and behaviors were once again being blamed for racial disparities and inequities, while anti-Black racism was exonerated on the altar of racial progress. On January 10, 2000, the Harvard University sociologist Orlando Patterson guaranteed that by 2050, the United States will have problems aplenty, but no racial problem whatsoever. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor cut that time period in half in a 2003 case upholding some forms of affirmative action in university admissions. "We expect that 25 years from now," she wrote, "the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest approved today." The election of Obama in 2008 became the final proof to some that the United States had achieved the ultimate victory of racial progress, the end of racism. This message was offered as much to Black Americans as to non-Black Americans. In a post-election piece published in the Los Angeles Times, Hoover Institution fellow Shelby Steele asked, "Doesn't a Black in the Oval Office put the lie to both Black inferiority and white racism? Doesn't it imply a post-racial America?" In 2008, the General Social Survey asked whether Black Americans have worse jobs, income, and housing than white people, mainly due to discrimination. Only 35% of Americans answered yes, the fourth lowest anti-racist response in three decades of polling. During his second term, on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington in 2013, President Obama stood on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. He declared, "The arc of the universe may bend toward justice, but it doesn't bend on its own." Obama was referring to a phrase from Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1956 speech after the Montgomery bus boycott. "The arc of the moral universe, although long, is bending toward justice." King himself had paraphrased the words of Theodore Parker, a Unitarian minister and abolitionist who before the Civil War had believed emancipation was coming. "I do not pretend," Parker wrote, To understand the moral universe, the arc is a long one. My eye reaches but little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight. I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure it bends towards justice. President Obama often paraphrased the quote in speeches. He even had the phrase woven into the rug in the Oval Office. In his farewell address in Chicago in 2017, President Obama told Americans that we're not where we need to be, but he assured the nation, the long sweep of America has been defined by forward motion, a constant widening of our founding creed to embrace all and not just some. The arc of the moral universe is indeed long, and as Obama observed, it doesn't bend on its own. The people bend it toward justice or injustice, toward equity or inequity. The long sweep of America has been defined by two forward motions. One force widening the embrace of Black Americans, and another force maintaining or widening their exclusion. The duel between these two forces represents the duel at the heart of America's racial history. The myth of singular racial progress veils this conflict, and it veils the snowballing racism behind Black people today still weathering the highest unemployment and incarceration rates and the lowest life expectancy and median wealth compared to other racial groups. Until Americans replace mythology with history, until Americans unveil and halt the progression of racism, an arc of the American universe will keep bending toward injustice.